People don't create computerized information unless they're going to share it. Think about how many copies that you back up, you save to the cloud. All of these copies live on.
Welcome to Commando On Demand, your fast-paced weekly update straight from Kim's desk to your ears. I'm Mike James, and today it's all about legal matters facing the digital lifestyle. The information that's getting sold about you and where we are as far as limiting big tech's control of our personal information. And our special guest today is Stephen Tepler. Now, Stephen's been a friend of the show for a long time, and he's been involved in cybersecurity and electronic discovery matters since 2000. Stephen's background is in technology, class action litigation. Yeah, he's a lawyer, as well as electronic discovery, and he has extensive expertise on cybersecurity, privacy, and much, much more. Kim and Stephen are going to talk about so much that's going on with the legal matters of digital lifestyle right now, like the digital rights of owners and secondhand owners and sellers of things like the Tesla. Yeah, did you know they turned off some extra features when somebody sold a used Tesla? Plus, later on, the Internet of Things, and what rights do you have to control your information on things like the Nest's thermostat? How deep fakes can cause hundreds of thousands of dollars in losses, and telltale signs of deep fakes, and all that and much more today on Commando On Demand, starting in just a few moments. And a quick reminder here, this is not the Kim Commando Show. Every week, Kim, of course, gives you the very latest in tech news. We've got tips, DIYs, and we take your questions on the Kim Commando Show. For that podcast, just go to getkim.com. It's really easy. It's a few bucks a month, and you get much more. You can watch the show live and chat with the other community members, blog, and so much more. And a quick little secret, if you use promo code Kim, you'll get a 7-day free trial, no obligation. Just try it and see if you like it. Again, that's getkim.com, promo code Kim for a 7-day free trial. All right, it's Commando On Demand. We're going to get right into it. The legal matters facing the digital lifestyle today. It's Kim Commando's interview with Stephen Tepler.
So, Stephen, it's been a while since we spoke. How have you been?
I have been great, Kim. Thanks so much for having me on.
So, just for anybody who is unfamiliar with Stephen Tepler, tell us a little bit about you and what you're doing.
Well, my practice revolves around technology. And it involves both litigation, either protecting businesses, individuals who are sued, or going out and going after wrongdoers, people who do bad things with computers or something similar to that. And this can include any kind of financial, medical, or personal information fraud. So that's pretty much what I do. And I also get involved in a little area called electronic discovery, which in litigation means trying to find stuff on computers and making sure that stuff stays where it is and doesn't get deleted.
But, you know, that's a whole other topic in and of itself. But so, Stephen, I know some of the cases that you worked on. Tell us about some of the big boys.
Well, some of the big ones we've been involved in have involved cases against hotels that have had major data breaches that have wound up having the victims experience identity compromise, either people impersonating them or using their passphrases or trying to get into their personal accounts and then compromising them that way. We've been involved in some, I would call it connected device litigation, where these connected devices either fail or they're not programmed properly or somehow have privacy implications that cause information that's personal or financial to be, to be sucked out and basically available for sale on the dark web.
So, Stephen, I was reading this crazy story about Tesla this morning about they have that self-driving technology. And a guy was killed in Mountain View, California in 2018 because he had his car self-driving mode, right? Which they always say, you know, you're supposed to be paying attention. I don't know if you heard, but he was actually playing a video game on his phone when the car crashed.
Yeah, you know, there's still these automated vehicles or semi-autonomous vehicles are still imperfect. You know, they can't envision every potential possible problem or event that might happen driving. However, I think that there's still a requirement on the part of drivers to pay attention I've heard stories where people have actually fallen asleep while their Teslas have been driving, and then some of them get into accidents. But the rule is still that you have to be attentive and keep your hands on the wheel, or be attentive enough to be able to take control of the vehicle.
Right. A little common sense. I mean, no, Candy Crush could not be that important, okay, in order to get to the next level.
No. And in fact, I just read an article yesterday where it's either, I'm not sure they were Tesla, so I don't want to pin this on that particular vehicle, but apparently having pictures of things that don't belong, or things that are not necessarily found in roads or on motorways, can actually confuse these vehicles into doing things that are unexpected.
You know what? I'm familiar with that story. It's actually, if we're thinking of the same one, it was a Tesla where the speed limit was 35 miles per hour. So the Tesla artificial intelligence said, okay, I should be going 35. Well, they said, you know, I wonder what would happen if we took a piece of black electrical tape and just extended the middle part of the three. So, and we're not going to circle it, so it's not going to be an eight, but we're just going to make that elongated. And the car sped up to 85 miles per hour.
That's true. And I think it could defeat its speed limiter. But there are also, there was also an issue where putting an image in front of the vehicle would cause it to think differently than the reality that was in front of it, which also, which basically winds down to, you know, what is artificial intelligence? And artificial intelligence is just that, it's artificial. It's not complete. It learns as it goes. But two points about artificial intelligence have to be kept in mind. Number one is that if it's programmed wrong, it'll keep learning wrong. Or if it learns something wrong and builds on that, it will keep building on a mistaken assumption. And so, you know, the artificial intelligence, again, is only as good as we can create it to be.
Which is very true. Now, you know, and I know an interesting story about if you ever want to buy a used Tesla. Talk to us about that.
Well, the world is turning into the commercial world, the world of finance, or actually the world of goods, are turning into a world of services. So when you think you're buying an item, like a car, what you're really doing is not buying a car, you're buying a service. And the story that you just mentioned has to do with a poor gentleman who purchased a used Tesla, I believe it was from another vehicle owner, and thought he was buying this Tesla with, you know, options A, B, C, and D. And with Tesla, when you purchase the vehicle, you have to purchase your separate options. I think there are certain types of cameras and sensors and capabilities.
It gets pretty crazy.
And
it gets pretty crazy because you can buy the regular package, the premium package, the regular car, the better car. And just for giggles, my husband Barry and I were sitting at the kitchen counter the other day. We're like, you know what? I wonder how much a Tesla is. I mean, you know, if we really wanted to buy a Tesla, because we bought a second home, and inside the second home garage, there's the electrical chargers for a Tesla. So I'm like, hey, you know, maybe we should just look at buying a Tesla. By the time we priced it out, it was $108,000, which is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks just like the $35,000 Tesla, but as you mentioned, it has the upgrades on the inside.
That's right. And all of these upgrades are already installed in the vehicle. All they have to do is be activated. And so that's the good news. The bad news is that this poor gentleman who purchased this used Tesla wound up buying what he thought was a fully loaded option Tesla. And when Tesla found out that he was the subsequent owner, the new owner of the car, they turned off those options. And they basically sent him an email or some sort of message saying, well, if you want these options, you'll have to pay us, I think it was $6,000 or $7,000. And he thought he was buying a Tesla with the options. And so this brings up an issue of, you know, what are you really buying when you buy something? And how much of what you buy is really a service for which you'll have to pay or maybe keep on paying every year? And if you ever sell the device, the car, or what have you, does that capability travel with it? And I don't think, from a legal perspective, I think there's a real issue of disclosure when you purchase, both when you purchase the vehicle or the item, And, you know, what is the responsibility of a seller? If a seller doesn't know that, that what they have is really, you know, just, you know, married to that person and not to any subsequent buyer.
So basically, if the seller didn't disclose this to the buyer, because maybe the seller didn't realize it, the guy paid for the options. Now he's sitting there, well, not necessarily with a paperweight, but pretty darn near close.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And a probably I will wager that somewhere in pages and pages and pages of the contract and disclaimers and warranties and reps that you get from Tesla is a little line or two that says, we hereby grant you a revocable limited license to options X, Y, and Z. They are not transferable. And so if that's there, then there may be a problem for the buyer, but certainly when the buyer buys it, where is he going to find that out until he actually purchases the car?
Which is interesting to me. Anybody who owns a Tesla, Stephen, they are so proud of their Tesla, aren't they? Well, here I have a Tesla. I don't have to go to the gas station. It has self-driving mode. Yeah, go ahead, try to sell it.
Yeah, and what happens if Tesla decides to stop offering a certain option? You know, can it? This almost brings you back to the Amazon case where we were involved in this case back when I was at my old firm, where Amazon took out a version of 1984 from all the Kindles, where it had promised in its terms and conditions that it would never take content out. It would only upgrade the system. But as it had turned out, it was selling through Kindle a non-licensed, a copyrighted version of 1984. And so it stripped out every version of that copy of 1984 from everyone's Kindle, including this poor student who had annotated this the book for his book report and wound up just, you know, totally having it taken away from him. This is kind of the dark side of what of technology offerings these days. You know, if you have a refrigerator, if you don't upgrade your refrigerator, what happens? Is your refrigerator going to turn off? Are you going to have less capabilities in it? If you ever sell it, what do you do? You know, for every connected device you have in your home, when you sell your home and those connected devices kind of travel with the home because you're not going to take them, what does a subsequent buyer do? Are we required to disclose or what?
Don't forget, if you have a question about something digital, Kim is here for you. You can get unbiased tech advice that you can trust. America's digital pro. Just go to commander.com and in the upper right hand corner, click on Be a Caller. Once you do that, we'll ask you a few questions about your question and we'll set up a time where you can come on the show and ask Kim what you have in mind. More of Kim's conversation with cyber lawyer Stephen Tepler just ahead. The Internet of Things and what rights do you have to control your information on things like the Nest thermostat? Well, Commander listeners know technology moves really fast and it's, of course, almost impossible to keep up with everything that's going on. And that's why we've got Commando On Demand for you. It's our way of keeping you informed and on the cutting edge of technology. We continue with Kim's conversation with the cyber lawyer, Stephen Tepler.
When we talk about the Internet of Things, there are so many problems with that that I just don't think that the average person realizes when they bring a smart TV, a smart refrigerator, as you mentioned, a smart washer and dryer, a camera even, a doorbell. Think about even what's happening now with Ring and having all this surveillance video, speaking of Amazon.
Yeah, you know, you have Ring is one of these unicorns that, you know, just basically catapulted into, you know, multi-billion dollar status and then was taken over by Amazon. But this is a prime example, no pun intended, of engineering not being done at the outset, not designing your device for security and not designing your device to think about how it's going to operate in the real world rather than, hey, you know, we turned it on, it works, it records, it sends information. Gee, that's enough. Let's go to market. These days, that's not enough.
What should Ring have done or any future doorbell manufacturer that as they come forward?
What Ring had not done was build in security measures, and I believe it was either two-factor authentication or some other authentication method, which would make sure that the device could not be hacked into by third parties. With two-factor authentication, for those of your listeners who do online banking, for the most part, you know, you'll log on to your online bank and they'll send you a text message or give you a call or send what's called an out-of-band message to you to say, hey, is this really you who's asking for access? And then you will answer with either a yes if it's vocal or a six-digit number if you get an authenticator message, and then you're good to go. With the amount of money that's involved, with the amount of profit that's involved, you'd think that you could build that into these devices kind of at the outset, and it kind of confuses me or boggles the mind. It just amazes me that it's not thought about these days, considering that even, 2 weeks ago, we had a huge breach at Marriott. You had a large, it was a global foreign exchange company that was hacked as well and was taken offline by ransomware. I mean, this should be at the top of everybody's mind, whether you're in business or an individual these days.
But see, that's just it with tech. It just seems like we have this great product. Let's bring it to market. You know, I was looking at a crazy product this morning. Okay, think about this, Stephen. How many times would you actually need this? You have your iPhone, right? So in the power port, you would put in a microphone about the size of a pack of gum, okay? You fire up the app and it tells you what kind of bats are flying overhead. Okay. And I'm like, all right. Okay. So this is $179. And I was looking, I'm shaking my head going, why is that? I mean, why would anybody think that this would be a great idea? But it goes where every tech company now is collaborating. They're collecting data. We're not really sure where it is. I think there's a certain percentage of all of us that's like, okay, my data has already been breached. What more can they do to me? Right. What more can they get from me? And it's kind of a lackadaisical attitude, but it just becomes white noise after a while because we see data breach after data breach after data breach. You know, companies promising credit monitoring, credit reports, or whatever it may be. But at the same time, we are giving away a lot of our information for free, and then the companies take it, you know, whether or not we read the terms and conditions in an app or what. Wherever that data may end up, I don't think we really know. Like with this Internet of Things and everything associated with it, I don't think a lot of people realize how much data that they're giving away, up to and including every time it phones home with that data.
You bring up some great points. And the way I look at it is this. You have two types of data being out there, personal data being out there. One is where you provide personal information such as your name, your ID, a social security number, what have you, the stuff that all states right now require notification for in the event of what we call an exfiltration or a breach. It's when the cow leaves the barn, so to speak. And that's one area. Another area of information that people aren't quite aware about is the information that you alluded to, which is I use a TV, I use a smart TV, I'll use a refrigerator that's connected, I'll use a coffee pot for crying out loud that's connected. But let's take an example. So I have a smart TV at home. The manufacturer shall remain unnamed, but it starts with an S. And in order to, they have an application called Smart Hub. And it's really a wonderful application. Instead of having a separate Roku device or what have you, I can get Hulu or Roku, whatever, through the Smart App, which is great because it means one less piece of metal and plastic in my living room. But in order to use it, you have to be able to click on their terms and conditions. And the terms and conditions include the ability to take in all of your viewing information. Forget about your cable company for the moment, all of your viewing information and do what they want with it. And that it's troublesome.
Is that data anonymized or obviously it's personally identifiable at some point if I fill out the product registration form and my IP address? I mean, so while they may say it's anonymized, it'd be pretty easy to figure out that it was you watching Judge Judy.
With the amount of information that's out there from all of the devices that's being gathered, you can basically take 3 or 4 points of information and pretty much guess who should be targeted with ads or who should be flooded with mail or targeted for something more nefarious. That's the problem. As we leave more and more data points to create that digital person, that digital ghost image of us online, we make it easier to be able to pinpoint who we are. So for instance, and I'll use, there was another case, I've got a few of these to talk about. One of which was, let's call it a sex toy. And this sex toy was connected. And every time it was a sex toy that was designed for women, they're for men, they're for women, and no more graphic detail other than that the usage was sent to the manufacturer. The manufacturer was sued under the Illinois Biometric Privacy Act, and the manufacturer settled for like $10 million. But the question is, why were they gathering all this information? And you think to yourself, why would they gather this information? But information is monetizable. And so this usage information from the manufacturer's perspective could be sold to advertisers who might say, in certain parts of the United States at certain times, and in fact, certain types of households, that's when this usage is done, and maybe we're going to put ads in for other types of devices or other things that might be romantically oriented, so to speak. And so everything that you do will have some utility to somebody for some reason, not only medical information, not only financial information, but it's the way that you lead your life from moment to moment to moment. So every time you buy food online, every time you Amazon, for example, gathers more information than Facebook or even Google, I think, at this point. So you have to look at two types of information. One is the quote unquote anonymized or pseudonymized information, which at this point can be readily what we call de-anonymized. You can re-identify people or re-identify close enough so that you can identify people, even by zip code or by street. And then, probably shouldn't get me started on DNA testing, but I will tell you that depending upon what you do, if you want to get a DNA test, for example, for your Ancestry.com or one of those 123andMe type of organizations, you might think, well, this is private medical information. It's covered by HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability Act and Accountability Act, but guess what? It's not, because you're not providing it through a doctor. You're not going through your insurance company. You're just sending us a biometric sample to a company that can then take that information and resell it and sell it over and over again.
Which is what basically 23andMe, they sold it to a medical pharmaceutical company.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are getting these DNA tests, and a lot of people get them for fun, curiosity, I got one. Because I wanted to know if I had any mutations in my DNA after my mother was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. But as you say, it wasn't done through a doctor. It was done through a website. What's interesting is that if I had done the DNA test, the same DNA test through a medical facility, that DNA test would have cost me $5,000. I did it through the website. It was $299.
And it also depends on the lab that does this analysis. But what's even more interesting is that even if you get it done through your insurance, I'm aware of certain options that you're given where your copay will either be larger or smaller depending upon whether or not you agree to let them use your DNA profile for commercial purposes.
What would be some commercial purposes? How would you define that?
Oh, selling. Well, you would send. So your DNA would be sent with other information. It may not be sent with your name, but it will be sent with your geolocation. It will be sent possibly with your age. It will be sent with other indicators that, this sounds like I'm creating an actuarial table for an insurance company to decide whether or not a certain group of people in the Northwest seem to have a greater predilection to getting certain types of cancers. And if that's the case, we're just going to up the insurance rates for that portion of the country. Why? Because all of this genetic information we're getting shows that they have markers for this type of cancer. Or you can have that for employment purposes and say, well, you know, this person seems to have, you know, kind of a genetic pattern that might make it more expensive for us to provide insurance for that person. Or perhaps they have, you know, a genetic predisposition to epilepsy or whatever you can link to a genetic cause. Without actually having that that condition be expressed, you could be penalized for it.
Hey, you can keep up to date with breaking news, security alerts, data breaches, and so much more with Kim Komando's newsletters. They're absolutely free, and you can get yours at komando.com. That's KOMANDO.com. And click at the top of the page on newsletters, and you got them. Just ahead, it's more of Kim's conversation with Stephen Tepler. They're going to talk about deepfakes and how can you spot deepfakes and not lose hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Facebook has been trying to go after medical records for many years and doing some joint ventures and partnerships with hospitals and medical records companies and things of that nature, which I always thought, you know, so here you have maybe a 55-year-old guy who's overweight and has heart issues, and he posts up on Facebook about how this is like the greatest hamburger and French fries that he ever had. So we take that information. Now we're going to combine it with other stats about this particular person. And I don't see why we shouldn't think that the insurance companies don't have all this data.
Oh, I'm sure they're hankering for it. I mean, there's if I were the insurance company, I would certainly want as much information as I could gather about a pool of insureds. You know, the issue is number one, it's you're giving this information involuntarily, and there isn't enough disclosure about what this information can be used for. At the very least, if you're going to get that free DNA test, there should be that kind of disclosure to say we can sell this to anybody we like, including A, B, C, and D type of companies or data aggregators. And in addition, the new California Consumer Privacy Act kind of works to help protect people, though.
Let's talk about that California Privacy Act, because we have a similar ruling in Europe with the EU. What's going on in California specifically with that act?
So in California, if you run a business and your business for the lowest common denominator for coverage for being subject to the law is $25 million in annual revenues and one resident in California, you will be subject to complying with the California Privacy Act, the Consumer Privacy Act of 2018, which became enforceable as of January 1. What that does is it requires disclosure by these companies that gather any personal information to disclose what they do, to disclose that they collect information, to disclose whether they've collected that information about a person within the last 12 months, and give that person the right to either access it and find out exactly what was collected about them, including cookies and beacons and all sorts of stuff that you would never be able to retrieve normally. But also it allows you to direct that these companies not sell your information. You can actually, now you must, as a business, you must provide your consumers or the people who visit your website with the ability to opt out of having their information sold, whether or not you register with that particular company. So even if you visit the site and the site drops a cookie on your computer, you have a right to say, don't sell my information and tell me what you're gathering from me.
So how do you know if you visit a website that they are adhering to the California Privacy Act?
You will see a notification usually on the landing page that says California residents here, or please see our revised Privacy Act. But as soon as you'll also see a do not sell hyperlink pretty much early on, almost when you click on, or as soon as the information is going to be gathered from you, you will have that notification pop up. You'll also have what's called a cookie bot, which is, and if anybody's recently gone online in the last year, you'll see that people are now seeing, we gather cookies for blank, blank, blank purposes. Your continued use of our website signifies your consent to our collection of cookies. Okay. And you have to collect, you basically have to agree to that. But for the California Privacy Act, there has to be, in addition to a privacy policy, which if you're online, your company, and you don't have one, is really kind of asking for a lot of trouble. You now have to have either a unified privacy policy, which incorporates the rights that are given to consumers in accordance with the act, or provide a supplement. And even though this is where the catch is, which makes it more of a national law and scope, if you're a company from Kansas, but you're doing $25 million a year or more in revenues, and it's not that hard for a company to do that, to look at the number of companies that have that kind of revenue, and you have one or more California residents as a user of your website or a customer, you're covered, and you have to provide the options.
Well, that's, you know what, that's really far reaching. But you bring up an interesting point, if I can switch gears for just a second, because you're also an expert on this. And I want to tap into your expertise about electronic discovery and the records that we keep on our phones and on our desktops and our tablets and our laptops and whatever device that we're using. You know, I have a longstanding saying that is, whatever you put online is there forever. Is that true in your experience?
Data has a very, very, very long life. And data tends to be in more than one place. Think about it this way. People don't create computerized information unless they're going to share it, unless you keep an autobiography that you'll never right. publish. But think about that. And then think about how many copies of any particular item that you've created, any particular document or record that you have, that you back up, you save to the cloud, or that you send to a family friend or an associate. All of these copies live on. And so there's a functional issue about data life, that, you know, a data lifespan, number one. But, even if you try to delete information off your computer, unless you're very, very adept at knowing how to completely wipe out that information, even if it's that's the only copy of that information that's available, a good forensic examination might be able to recapture all, if not at least some of that information, whether it's on a phone, whether it's on a tablet, whether it's on a USB stick, and even if it's in the cloud, because in the end, your cloud computing, your cloud storage, whatever you're using in the cloud, really winds up being in some server somewhere anyway, either in a solid state drive or a hard drive.
Now, which is very true. And when you're looking at computer forensics, what kind of tools do they use?
They use very specialized tools that are designed to, and I'll get a little technical here, so forgive me, and I'll try to make it as simple as possible. When you turn on a computer, generally, you change thousands of files. Just by turning on the computer, your system files, your log files, even without creating a document. So this causes a problem when you want to take information out of a computer and use it in evidence, because you want the original stuff. You want stuff that hasn't been changed. You want files that haven't been changed. You want to have a snapshot of that system and that data that exists as of the time that you're asserting its importance. So what the technologists have developed are certain types of hardware and software which can actually prevent a computer from overwriting information as it copies information out of the computer. And so they get a pristine copy of everything that's on the computer that they can compare using very sophisticated cryptographic techniques to say, yes, this is the exact information I took from this computer as a forensic examiner at this time. And this is why when you watch TV, and, you know, the door gets banged open and all of a sudden, you know, somebody shouts, get away from the computer. Do not turn it off. That's why they do that.
I always like when they say the password and they type in this password. And I'm like, oh, please, we don't even need that. We can go totally bypass that whole password screen. You know, in your in your experience and in these cases, has there been a case with forensics and electronic discovery that surprised even you?
Yes. There was a case where we were involved that had to do with a written contract. And the written contract appeared to be pretty believable. I mean, it was enough. It was believable enough to get to a jury, perhaps, even though there are questions about its authenticity, whether it had been aged, whether or not it had been altered, you know, physical stuff to do with paper that would make it seem like it was genuine. But what we found out was that the actual, when we recovered the hard drive from the individual, what we found out was that there had been numerous iterations of that contract with the alterations in little pieces on the computer that normally would not have been retrievable without a forensic examination. And so even though the paper copy might have been able to go to the jury, the evidence of a problem and real potential forgery was demonstrated at least enough to get it, you know, to call the authenticity of the document into great doubt.
Now, does the fact that so many businesses, including our own, are using Google Docs right now, and you see every iteration of a particular document, does that make your job more difficult for electronic discovery?
It does, because my understanding is that Google Docs does not record every keystroke. So if you save versions, if you version something up, that's one thing. But if it's a collaborative document, how do you take a picture of the dynamic interaction as three people edit a document online? Who did what and when? Now, there probably is, I would not doubt that Google has some sort of mechanism to say that computer user A at IP address associated with this Google email address did this at this time, but we're not sure just how granular that gets. In other words, did they add the not into that paragraph, or did they just sign in and help edit the document itself? So we don't know how granular that is. So you're right that from an evidentiary perspective, that can be problematic.
We used to use.
Then you have deep fakes, of course.
Well, you just threw in deep fake.
I know. I had to do that. No, you know, I wouldn't let you go without talking about that.
Okay. So, you know what? And I like that transition. I have to tell you, looking at the technology, I'm kind of petrified of this, that using common tools that are available online, you don't have to go to the dark web for these things at all. You can take a video, a photo, somebody's voice, make them do anything. Like, for example, I read that story about the company in Germany where guy got a call from his boss and said, hey, you know what? We have this vendor. He's sitting on me for payment, and I need you to go ahead and wire $250,000 right now. So this way the guy gets off my back. The guy wires the money. It's his boss. Why would he not, right? And then a week later, the guy calls again and says, oh, you know what? We need to give this guy another $300,000 or whatever the number was. And that's when he said, this is really strange because my boss really doesn't ever do this. Meanwhile, they're out $250,000, and it was deep fake voice technology that pulled that crime off.
You bring up two really important issues. Number one is anytime someone asks you to do a financial transaction online, you should always question it. Make a phone call. And if the threat actors, that's who we call the criminals, if the threat actors wind up doing enough social engineering to know that your boss is climbing Mount Everest and doesn't have a cell phone on, you have to make that reasoned decision to say, maybe this isn't real. But that's one part of that. The other part is, think about deepfake technology has gotten good enough so that you can do an impersonation long enough, as you point out, to commit fraud, to commit identity theft, to get health care that you're not entitled to cause wire transactions, to cause fraudulent wire transactions, to make people leave their houses, right? Think about, impersonating an EMS or some sort of police department where they say, you know, there's a fire, there's whatever, everybody has to evacuate now, and then you have massive burglaries or robberies that take place as a result. Deepfake technology is dangerous. It's getting better. And if you go to court with a deepfake video, you may be able to get it admitted into evidence. And until you can prove that it's fraudulent, you'll have a real problem. There are some technologies that will help you do that, but they're not in common use yet. And so, of course, as with any other technology, the criminal elements will always use it first because that's the easiest way to get to the money.
I tried to research this answer myself in looking at deep fake videos. I was unable to come up with a clear cut decision. So maybe you know, is there like one characteristic, something that stands out in a deep fake video that you can look at and go, fake, not true?
There is. And I think that aside from video discontinuities, which will always show up, there's an issue of time. And you really have to look at the time that the deepfake video is purported to have been made. And you've got to look at the metadata, all the contextual information that you don't normally see in connection with that type of data. And typically, if a threat actor isn't smart enough, the date of creation of a deepfake video will not comport with the date that it's supposed to have been that the event's supposed to have been happened. I call it, you have to look at digital information as having two aspects. You have content and you have time. And if the time doesn't match what the content is saying, that's a clear indicator that it's a fraud. If you're a sophisticated threat actor, you can backdate information, et cetera, but that's not easy to do. And there are ways to, there are technologies that can be used to help establish what we call the provenance or the validity of that information as having existed at the time it was generated.
Steven,
now you're getting into my technical stuff. I teach this in law school. So you just got my first two classes.
For free in a podcast.
Yeah. What can I tell you? No test.
Steven, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. And I know we could just keep talking for at least another 40 minutes. And if any of folks are listening right now, you want to get in touch with Steven, just reach out to me through the website. Head over to commando.com. And there's a link right at the bottom that says contact us. Yes, Smarty Pants. That's where you click. Send me a note and then I'll go ahead and forward it over to Steven. Once again, Steven, thanks for joining us. Come back soon, please.
I will. It's been a pleasure, Kim. Thanks again for having me on.
You got it.
As always, thank you for listening to Commando On Demand. We do appreciate it. If you like what you hear, don't forget to tell a few friends about us and, of course, share us on your social media page. And if you haven't already, subscribe. What's stopping you? It's a lot of great information every single week on Commando On Demand. Again, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.